Thanks for joining us now for KVC Arts. Arts and entertainment as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming. Tower of Power has provided over 50 years of funk and soul with a capital S, and they'll be in our region soon. The band came about, in a way, through another band, the Motowns. But it's not that they were doing Motown covers. I spoke with Emilio Castillo, one of the founding members of Tower of Power.
I grew up in Detroit till I was 11, and then we came out to the Bay Area. And when I got into music as a teenager, and then finally got into soul music, we had a name. We were called the Black Orpheus, and we didn't like that. We were going to change it. And my mother said, and you know, we were teenagers, and my mother was like the manager. And she said, you know, if you're going to be a soul band, you should call yourselves the Motowns because you're from Detroit. My brother was a drummer, so two of us were from Detroit. But it wasn't that we played so much Motown music, really, because mostly we were playing James Brown and Memphis Soul and New York Soul music. We did a few Motown things, but mainly because we were from Detroit.
Then definitely the place, not so much the style. You were already doing the soul and the funk and whatnot. By the time, what was it, a July 4th, maybe a state fair performance when you met and auditioned Doc Kupka?
Yeah, July 4th, 1968, that weekend, and I offered him an audition. He came a couple of weeks later, but we were playing soul music 2 years before that. You know, we got into it around 66.
I also understand that it was your dad that pulled you aside and advised you to hire Doc. Do you recall what his words were or the import of that statement?
Very clearly, yeah. My dad never interfered with the band. You know, he was very supportive. He bought us all our instruments. He built a stage for us in the garage. He was very supportive, but he never interfered. And on the day that Doc auditioned, he came out into the garage and he was watching for a second and he said, Mimi, come in the kitchen. My nickname is Mimi. He said, you need to come in the kitchen. And he went in there. I thought I was in trouble. He said, hire this guy. He's got something. And I said, he does, huh? And that was it. I went out and told the guys, he's in. And they all went, yeah. And that was it.
Then is credited with you when you go into the band's bios and whatnot, credited with writing most of the Tower of Power song catalog. So was that just an instant groove between the two of you, this instant click that made it all start happening? Because wasn't it about the same time that you went away from so many covers as you did starting to write original music?
Your You know, I give Doc all the credit for that. I was very creative. We did covers, but we did them our own way, and I was sort of the driving force of that. I used to mess with the rhythms and come up with these different background parts and put a different flair on the horn parts. And he came to me and he said, you know, what you're doing with these songs is so amazing, but why are we doing it to other people's music? Why don't we write our own? And, you know, I don't know if I would have ever thought of that. I was totally happy doing what I was doing, but I said, no, we can try that. And we got together, and the first song we wrote, one of our biggest songs, You're Still a Young Man.
That's right. I've got a nice live recording of that. And so I suppose I wanted to bring that up in the sense that we think of Tower of Power, and I automatically go to things like Soul with a capital S, Digging on James Brown, and Funk the Dumb Stuff, and all that kind of stuff. We'll address that title a little bit later. But then going on to You're Still a Young Man, such a wonderful, soulful ballad. It's not the funk, but still, this was a huge one for y'all.
You know, it was our first song that we wrote, but when we did our first album, David Rubinson was the producer. He was a big San Francisco Bay Area producer at the time, and he thought the song was too mushy, and he wouldn't let us record it.
Oh.
But we had been playing it since 68, and we recorded it in 1970. And then when we did Bump City in 1971, that was our second album, and by then we were signed to Warner Brothers. We recorded it, and, you know, we told Steve Cropper right off, you know, we want to do this ballad. It was a big part of our sound. We not only played up-tempo music, but we had these heart-wrenching ballads, you know, and that song came out, and that was our first national hit. And that song was bigger than any song we've ever done, you know, So Very Hard to Go and What Is Hip and Don't Change Horses and This Time It's Real. But You're Still a Young Man, even to this day, it's more play than all of them.
You mentioned Steve Cropper just a second ago. Is this the same Steve that's mentioned in the same breath as Donald Duck Dunn and all the Memphis crowd?
Yeah, Steve Cropper produced our second record, Bump City. And he also produced a few records later, another record called We Came to Play. And, you know, I was watching him produce Bump City, and that's after that I started producing the band. I learned a lot from him. And we were, you know, he was one of our idols just growing up. We were really, really into that Memphis soul sound. And he's basically responsible for that.
Absolutely. That whenever you can go back into whether it's the Memphis horns or the rhythm section that people would know from the Blues Brothers movies, it's a cool sound that came out of this grouping. You were wanting to get to the Fillmore. I'd like to hear the story of this. I understand that you were wanting to get to the Fillmore, but knew you wouldn't get there dressed as sharp as you did when the band was the Motowns with the slick suits and everything. And so did you not have a bit of a reverse image adjustment, actually growing the hair out, trying to be more hippie-like?
You know, it was the times. I mean, everybody was doing that, and we were sort of in a little microcosm in the East Bay. there were soul bands that dressed up in suits, and you know, and then you saw the soul stars of the day all wearing suits and having bands that dressed like that. But a lot of those bands were getting booked into the Fillmore. You know, Otis Redding had been booked there, and Sam and Dave had been booked there, and Booker T and the MGs, and everything was going to the Fillmore Auditorium. And that was really the place to play. We were playing these little dive black nightclubs in the East Bay, and you know, we wanted to get in there, and everybody was trying to audition, and they had a new record label that they had started, and people were submitting tapes. So we wanted to get in there, and we knew we were going to get in dressed in suits and with a name like the Motowns. And so, you know, Doc was the first hippie we had ever met, and we all sort of started being like him, you know, and he had a real sort of character way of talking, and, you know, he just influenced all of us, and we sort of, you know, all went in that direction. But we weren't the only ones. I mean, the whole Bay Area was leaning that way, and eventually that's where everything went, you know.
Around the same time, and this ties into the Fillmore with Bill Graham and all, I'd love to hear about the time that you went to Detroit to visit your parents with the intention of possibly not coming back, but then everything started happening.
Well, what happened is, you know, we got ourselves an audition date. They used to have these things called Tuesday night auditions. You had to sign up, and, you know, and then they would assign you a date, you know, and we had a date for the end of 1969. It was in November, I think, or, you know, early December. And, you know, by the time that date happened, we had been busted by the ABC, the Alcoholic Beverage Control, for being underage. And we had been playing nightclubs for about 3 years. So that's the only people that knew us were the people that went to nightclubs in the East Bay.
Yeah, local.
We didn't play any high schools. And so we had no gigs.
Oh, my gosh.
And by the time that audition came along, we were starving, you know, and things were falling apart. And all we did was rehearse and get ready for that gig. But I told the guys, I said, if something doesn't happen from this, you know, I got to go back and be with my parents. My parents told me they gave me a year to either make it or come back to be with them. We did the audition. You know, I had a ticket to go back for the holidays. And I told them, I said, I'm not coming back if nothing happens. And I got back there to Detroit, and Doc called me up, and he said, you got to come back. You got to come back. He dug it. And I said, who dug it? And he said, Bill Graham. And I said, hock my Vox organ and send me a ticket. And he did, and I came back on, and we got signed. And people were amazed because we were nobody. But David Rubinson saw something in us, and so did Bill Graham. Bill Graham always liked rhythm and horns, and Rubinson thought we were soulful, and they signed us to San Francisco Records.
Did you have any bit of a local crowd built in already since y'all came from Oakland? You were just across the bay there, or was it a completely different scene at the Fillmore as opposed to the nightclubs in the Oakland area?
You know, even in the East Bay, we were not that popular. We were known in a few nightclubs like Frenchies and Hayward and Beyond Broadway in Oakland by, you know, maybe 50 people that knew you could dance to this band, and they dug us. But we were virtually unknown. And as I said, we had been busted by the ABC, so we hadn't been gigging for almost a year. And certainly at the Fillmore, they had no idea who we were. So when we got signed, people were really amazed.
Now to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. I'm David Fleming. Let's go back to my conversation with Emilio Castillo, one of the founding members of Tower of Power at the SoCal Jazz and Blues Fest in Murrieta, running April 20th and 21st. More at SoCalJazzFest.com. In a band like Tower of Power, I have to ask, is it the rhythm section or the horn line? Those are two driving forces, and with some bands, it would be one or the other. I have to put them together for this.
Well, my thoughts are that they're both extremely important to the sound. Guitar players, there's a billion, you know. Horn sections, you can count them on your hand. So just the fact that we have a five-piece horn section you know, people notice that first. But truly, the rhythm section, I think, is what makes us really unique as well, because we don't approach rhythm like other bands do, and we never have. We always try to raise the bar as far as being creative rhythmically.
The guys that you have playing in the rhythm section as well, this is an incredible lineup, and so many people. I think there's, what, maybe four or five of the original members, but everybody has been with the band for quite some time, with the exception of your current lead singer, Ray Green. He may be the newest, is that right?
Yeah, he's definitely the newest, and he's not quite 2 years in. You know, my bass player, Francis Rocco Prestia, he and I, we're celebrating 50 years together. He was in my first band, you know, when I was 15 years old.
Oh, my God.
Doc's been with me since 68, so we're in our 48th year. David Garibaldi has been in and out of the band four times, but, you know, the last time he came in was 98. He's been here since then. So long timers here.
Yeah, even at the shortest stint for him, that's still 14, 15 years or so. That's incredible longevity. And I suppose it's just... the music is fun. I can't see you getting tired of being able to jam out on these kinds of tunes. It's just the kind of thing where you do. Just keep having fun. One tune in particular, beyond, you know, we mentioned Soul with a capital S and Digging on James Brown. One of the other ones, though, is Funk the Dumb Stuff. And I have to be very careful with the articulation on that one as we speak about this one. When you came up with the title, or who brought this one to the group?
You know, that was a phrase that Rocco used to use a lot, and he would curse even when he said it. But, you know, he said it a lot and said, you know, we ought to write a song called that. And so me and Doc, you know, sat down and we created a song around the bass line that he had, and then we came up with these verses, and we substituted the word funk, and it became very popular.
I can almost picture mothers in the audience turning and wondering if they heard that right, or if they needed to cover their kids' ears, or what the case was. It's one that I always want to have turned up and then end up turning down, depending on where I am in the neighborhood. Something that goes back to, I suppose, the earliest of days, as well as even just last year, your relationship with Neil Schon.
Well, a lot of people know him from Santana as well.
He was
the first guitar player that Carlos Santana hired. You know, Carlos Santana obviously is a very famous guitar player, but early in his career, he hired Neil Schon to be in the band. And at the time he was hired with Santana, he had also been asked to play with Jimi Hendrix. He was very popular, a young prodigy out of San Francisco, and he was actually in one of the opening bands the night we auditioned at the Fillmore.
Did you end up on a Journey tour? I suppose that's why I brought that up. I knew about the Santana thing. I didn't know about Jimi Hendrix, but didn't you guys have a recent tour with Journey, so this was a nice full circle thing for you?
Yeah, we did a long 42-day tour last year with Journey, and then they brought us out again, and we did 10 more dates. And that was kind of like old home week, because, you know, we've known Neil for years and years, and we know all those guys. And Steve Miller Band was on the bill as well. It was a great tour.
Looking at some of the players again, I noticed that Adolfo Acosta's credits include Maynard Ferguson. And I haven't caught it yet on my records, but does he ever burst out with that extremely high wail reminiscent of Ferguson?
He has a great range, really good range. And he was actually playing lead trumpet in the Maynard Ferguson band. We also had another lead trumpet player, and he's the one that brought Doffel to us. His name was Mike Bogart, and he was with us for several years, and he came from Maynard Ferguson as well.
So this is not new pickings for you. We were also talking about Ray Green earlier, your vocalist. I noticed that he has trombone in his background. Is he strictly a vocalist with Tower of Power, or does he still bring out a bit of the brass every so often?
No, we try to get him on the bone whenever we can. I mean, obviously he's singing lead, so he can't do it that much live, although we do have him playing on a few tunes and a few solo sections. But we brought him into the studio. We're recording a new all-original record, and he's already done 14 tracks with the horn section, and we're getting ready to go in and do the other 16 tracks. We're basically recording a little more than two albums worth of material, and we're going to pick the best 12 and release our record as soon as it's done. But he's an excellent trombone player, and we're just doubly blessed to have him in the band.
Oh, absolutely. And you guys are doubly blessed to have so many doublers, quite literally. Tom Pulitzer also, a quick question about him. I read that he started off with y'all on clarinet, but switched to baritone sax, and there's a note in there saying that this was inspired in part by the Tower of Power tune Squib Cakes.
When he joined the band, he was a tenor player, but when he first started playing music, he started on clarinet, and then he was drafted into a stage band a couple of years later, and they needed a baritone sax player. He didn't really want to play it, but one of the things that made him change his mind was they played Squib Cakes for him, and he heard Doc playing the baritone sax, and that inspired him.
Okay, simple as that. You mentioned the new album a second ago, and you're going to pick the best 12 on there. Do you already know that the remainder then, will that be the follow-up album?
No, we'll definitely be using the other material. It all sounds great. We're going to have a hard time picking the best 12, because it all sounds really good. We're very pleased. And it's all original, and I'm producing it with Joe Vanelli, who is the brother of Gino Vanelli, and produced all those great records by Gino Vanelli. And it turned out to be a really wise choice on my part to ask him to help. It's just such a big project, and, you know, we're doing it between tours, and it's a lot of work, and he's just an invaluable creative, and just musically and harmonically, and on every level, he's been an excellent help in producing the record, and I give him much credit for this record.
Do you have any idea on when the release date for this might be? You said you're going back into the studio in early October.
It's going to be a while. It's a huge body of music, and I'm going to completely finish everything before I choose the 12, and then we still have to mix it. You know, we have to do the cover and the credits, and it could be as long as two more years, you know, because we're a working band. You know, we don't take 6 months off and make a record. We can't afford to do that. So we get in when we can, and it takes quite a bit of time, but it's definitely come along a great, great way, and it's really taking shape. We're not in a rush. What's important is that we make the best album of our career. We're getting close to 50 years in the business, and I told the guys, this is not the time to slap together a record and throw one out. We need to make the very best record, and the way you do that is the Michael Jackson method. You record way more than you need, and you pick the best 12.
It's a nice way of putting it. Now, in the band's history, that's the thing. You've never stopped touring. And you go to your website, looks like starting in December, you're going to be throughout Europe, all around Germany, Switzerland, and whatnot. So is this the secret then? Never stopping. And it's not like the band called it quits at some point and then reformed a decade later. You have never stopped since 66 or 7 or so.
Well, you know, it's a blessing that we have a public that wants to see us. You know, our popularity grows. I wouldn't say that we're the kind of a group that comes out and releases a record and they're a smash hit and they go away. We're like the little train that could. We just keep growing and expanding globally, and we just got back from Japan, you know, last year. We got down to New Zealand, Australia. We're working on South America next. We're really just growing in little increments, and God's blessed us, and we're very grateful.
That is phenomenal. Emilio, I appreciate your time on this. I'm looking forward to the new album whenever that does happen, whether it's sometime 6 months or the next year. But in the meantime, fun stuff with all of the other albums. It would be hard to actually pick and choose an album. If you wanted to introduce somebody to Tower of Power, before I let you go, if you wanted to introduce somebody to Tower of Power, and not picking up in any of the best of albums, any kind of greatest hits, what's a good introduction for someone if you wanted to throw an album at them and say, this is it?
I think the one that people, you know, remember hits from and sort of the heyday of our career in the 70s, the one self-titled Tower of Power.
Yeah.
You know, it had So Very Hard to Go and What Is Hip and This Time It's Real. And then one right after it also, Back to Oakland. So those two were very popular albums for us. And a lot of people look back to that and say that was their heyday. Although we put out some great albums since and the band continues to grow. So I'm proud of all of it.
That's the nice thing. I started to go back and try to compare, you know, between liner notes or even sound between various eras of the band, at least what I had access to, and it's tough to do. Every incarnation of the band, there's consistencies and there's differences, but it's always been a fun driving force behind it.
It's a great band. I've had some great musicians over the years, certainly some great singers, great horn players, wonderful guitar players, drummers, and, you know, just great people, and it's really great to be able to travel the world and be with these people and fulfill the fans' desire to see us play this kind of music. We're sort of like the last ones on the block playing this kind of music, and very proud of it.
All right, well, Emilio, thanks for making the time for me.
David, thank you. God bless.
It's been conversation with Emilio Castillo, one of the founders of Tower of Power, continuing their more than 55 years of funk and soul with a stop in Murrieta soon with the SoCal Jazz and Blues Festival. More at SoCalJazzFest.com. More also at TowerofPower.com. And that wraps up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks again to Emilio Castillo, and here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, Tony Lopez, and Sheree Nawaz. Many past KVC Arts can be found through iTunes, NPR One, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and most past shows are at kvcrnews.org/arts. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support, which you can do any time of the year. Go to kvcrnews.org/support. And thanks again.